It's springtime here, which means it's mattress season, and mattresses are sprouting up everywhere I look outside. I'm kidding, of course, but if Mother Earth did grow mattresses on trees, she would grow avocado green mattresses, as they use sustainably sourced organic natural materials. As the season also brings the warm weather with it, I'm quickly reminded how important temperature is to our sleep quality. Staying cool overnight makes a big difference, and organic natural bedding sleeps cooler than the cheaper synthetic alternatives. For those who thought avocado only makes mattresses, they also make the most luxuriously soft bedding to keep you cool and comfy while catching those restful Z's. Whether you are looking for organic cotton, natural linen, down, or even silk, Avocado Mattress has everything you would want to upgrade your sleeping environment. Investing in better sleep always pays off. Head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age test? Well, I took it myself and the results are in. I found out my biological age, which directly predicts my risk for serious diseases. Here's why that matters. Research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. The good news is, nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hand. Yes, it's driven by things like your lifestyle, which means you have a lot of control over it. I was pleased to see my biological age was 6 years younger than my chronological age. That felt like a big win because I've definitely put a lot of time and attention on improving my lifestyle habits so they are more aligned with my health goals. The test also showed a few areas to work on and even pointed out a low level of riboflavin or vitamin B2, which plays a huge role in energy metabolism. It's strange because I felt there was something inhibiting my energy, and now I have a simple theory I can test. The True Age test didn't just give me a number, it showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, no doctor visit or big needles, just a quick, painless finger prick. You send off that tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com and use my code MINDFUL to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code MINDFUL at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
Ayahuasca is the combination of two plants. But the combination of the two plants opens up to a realm that people have called the world of ayahuasca, which is this entirely discrete universe that's within every person as well, that ayahuasca, the plant, the drink, opens the doorway to. And in there, there's tremendous intelligence, there's tremendous kindness, and there is an agenda to heal people. And that agenda to heal is really important because, you know, other plants don't have that. Like, for example, opium or has an agenda to numb.
Dr. Richard Grossman, thanks for joining me on the Mindful Movement podcast.
It is a pleasure. Nice to meet you.
I'm glad you reached out. 40 years of experience in the Asian medicines, acupuncture, Chinese medicine, natural health care. That's something that I've gravitated towards over the years when I learn about different healing modalities. And not a lot of people out there say they have 40 years experience of it. And it seems like the last couple of decades, you've spent a lot of time in Amazonian shamanism. And I guess you have a lot of tools in the toolkit.
Yeah. You know, I was told once that you can judge a person by the number of tools they have in their toolbox. And at that point, I decided to get as many tools as I could because, you know, the old adage, if you give a person a hammer, all they see are nails, is really true. And I hate using cliches, but I'll probably use a few because they work. But it's true because if a person only has a set number of ideas or tools or concepts or even beliefs, that's how they're going to perceive reality. That's how they're going to see that, how they can fix things. Like if I am carpenter, I was a carpenter for a while years ago, or I worked in construction years and years ago going through school, I would walk into a house to see what I could do. And what I could do is based on the tools in my toolbox and the tools, more importantly, up here.
Yeah, what do they say? You could turn a screwdriver around and use it as a hammer, but it's just not the same.
No.
It's like you want to find the right tool for the thing that you're trying to accomplish or cultivate at that time.
Yeah. And in healing, that's really important because there's two schools of thought on it. One is a person needs to specialize. So in Western medicine, we have skin doctors and eye doctors and ear doctors and nose doctors and stomach doctors and digestive doctors and bone doctors and muscle doctors and cancer doctors and, you know, dot, dot, dot. And each one has taken their specialty down to where they know more about that particular aspect of healing than does anybody else who's not a professional in that field. And that's really good, too. I don't knock specialization. But in this, you know, what we used to call holistic medicine, and I don't call it anything anymore because as soon as I call it something, somebody else will take it and turn it into something else. But, you know, this idea of the whole, treating the whole, which involves body, mind, and spirit, and, you know, digestion, nutrition, everything is part of what makes a person a whole person.
And the specialization, though useful, like it'd be more useful if they all communicated together, but they don't. So
yeah.
There's a value to being a generalist. And maybe if one day, maybe AI brings all the specialists together. So there is a all-encompassing generalist helping them guide. But if they're all just looking it through their lens, it's going to be... you're not going to see the whole picture. It's funny. I have a history of working in a gym environment with people, the physical body more. And over the years, you see specialization more and more and happening like at young ages. So you'll have like 9-year-old baseball pitchers. Whereas when you were young, you know, everybody did everything. Like everybody was a generalist first. And there's a price to pay of being a specializing. So you have a book that's out now, Trust and Forgive, the Medicine of Your Life. How did all this experience in these different healing modalities lead you to write a book about trust and forgiveness?
I think, you know, writing that book was quite a endeavor on my part because I'm not a writer. You know, I think before I wrote that book, the most I'd written was a few pages at a time and maybe a little short story here, a few paragraphs there, some Facebook posts here and there. And suddenly I'm, you know, sitting down and realizing that I'm going to be writing an 80,000 word book, excuse me. It's not 80,000 pages.
That might be a tough one to sell.
80,000 pages is chapter one, right? So how did I get there was, you know, when you read the book, when a person reads the book, they'll recognize something that it took me a while to recognize about myself. I've had a really wild life, and wild in that many extraordinary experiences have been part of who I am and part of what's influenced me and part of what made me who I am. So none of those things created me. For example, you know, we're talking about 9-year-old baseball players or pitchers. I start off the book by talking about something that happened to me, which was when I was around 9 years old, 10 years old. I don't remember exactly when we had an assignment in class for what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, what a ridiculous thing to ask a child, you know, really. But the whole gamut of the room, you know, the people in the room was, I want to be whatever their father was or whatever their mother was. I want to be a doctor. I want to be a lawyer. I want to be the president. I want to be a pilot. I want to be a fireman. You know, typical things kids come up with. I said I wanted to study the effects of plants on the mind. And mind you, I had no clue about plants. I had no clue about the mind. I had no clue plants could influence the mind. But that's what I said I wanted to study. And that took me on a ride.
Did you already have an interest in plants, or did this just come out of the blue?
The only interest I had in plants was my father was a pharmacist, and back then he was kind of like one of the transitional phases from old-time pharmacy to pill-pushing pharmacy. And so he had one little section of the pharmacy where he had a bunch of plants in jars that he would occasionally formulate for people. And he had a book on pharmacognosy, which is the science of medical plants. And I loved looking in that book, and I loved looking at the plants on the shelf. I didn't know why. I had no growing up interest in gardening or plants or anything. But there was like almost an innate fascination in me for this idea of utilizing plants for something that would affect the mind, that would affect the heart, that would affect the spirit. And again, I had no clue about heart, mind, and spirit back then. I was a naive little kid. Over time, it grew into really a deep curiosity, especially when I started experimenting with other more mind-altering plants as a teenager, and never doing it in the way of like, let's get high and, you know, have fun. But it was always, I'd get high on something or another and sit and close my eyes and go into meditative states. I didn't know about meditation, you know, so I was impelled into a certain direction. I think by my heart, by my soul, by spirit, by curiosity. I've always been an innately curious person about everything.
Okay. So maybe the early fascination was triggered by having the books laying around. Like, I remember answering that question that I wanted to be an astronaut in like the third grade when they asked you. And I had a book about all like the different rockets that NASA put up. And that was like one of the few books I had. So I like went through it all the time. And I'm sure that had something to do with me answering the question of, yeah, I want to be an astronaut.
Yeah, I'll never really know because, you know, of course, my memory of that time period is not super clear. I had to really do some deep digging to get it out into the book.
So what does all that have to do with trust and forgiveness?
Good question. So, you know, my healing journey took me into first kind of amateur diet, nutrition, yoga, qigong, tai chi, martial arts. And the problem that I had during that time period was I had been severely traumatized when I was about 5 years old by losing the tip of my index finger in a bicycle accident. There's a whole thing in the book about that. So whatever I did, whatever I looked at, whatever I tried to do to remove that kind of long-term subtle angst inside of me didn't work to what I was seeking, which was a heart wide open, a soul wide open, a mind unimpeded by baggage. And so trust and forgive came really when I started working with ayahuasca. And I don't want to spoil the book for people, but I'll do a little explanation of that one. So my first ayahuasca experience was extremely strong, extremely powerful. And to make a long chapter short, I found myself in a concentration camp in a 3D full immersion, everything but smell, walking in the snowy weather of Poland towards the execution place, towards the gas chambers. I'm sitting in this vision, recognizing it was a vision, right? It wasn't like a bad trip. It was like, what is going on here? But not enjoying it, not wanting to be there, not especially wanting to get to the front of that line and be shoved into a gas chamber and executed. You know, I was wondering if that happened during the experience, would I really die? You know, if I died in that gas chamber. But as I'm walking in this horrible situation, I'm like, what do I do here? I'm not praying to God. I'm not praying to spirit. I'm not praying to any deity. I'm just like, well, what do I do? How do I handle this? And almost like a voice, a feeling, a sensation came in and said, trust and forgive, which put me on a ride because like, I'm supposed to forgive this. I'm supposed to trust this. I'm supposed to let go of this. What is this? This is like one of the worst things that ever happened in human history. And I'm supposed to forgive it. I'm supposed to forgive Hitler. I'm supposed to forgive the Nazis. Every time I came up with an excuse, this voice just came back and said, trust and forgive. So I started thinking as I'm walking down this long line of people, what trust meant and what forgiveness really meant. I couldn't forgive in such a way that I made the situation okay. You know, a woman, for example, who's been raped can't forgive to make the rapist okay or to make the experience she had okay. But then the idea kept on deepening and deepening. And you're like, what is trust is really, and forgiveness is really letting go of any connection in my mind, in my heart, in my body, in my being, to that memory, because all trauma is memories. So as I did that, I was like, my forehead was starting to relax. I could feel my shoulders relaxing in the real world. I could feel my breath deepening. And at some point, the entire experience dissolved into nothing, into just nothing. Then something else came up, but that was a ride also.
Why do you think you had a vision of that? I mean, did you have ancestors that were involved in?
No, I have Jewish ancestry. So, but none of my, as far as I know, none of my ancestors were there. We were early arrivers in this country. But I think it's because I was like, the medicine was enrolling me as a healer. The ayahuasca was enrolling me as a healer. And kind of like, if I could handle that, I could handle anything.
Well, why did you initially even want to do it? You said this was your first experience with it. How old are you at the time, by the way? What are we talking about?
Early mid-30s.
What inspired you to want to do it? Were you actively going to try to heal from something? Or?
Yeah. I was trying to heal from that initial trauma I had.
So just the injury on the finger that you felt like you couldn't let go of.
Yeah, it was the fingertip was a nothing. I mean, not a nothing, it was a big deal there. But the repercussions of it in my life were a big deal. And so, I grew up with digestive disorders. I grew up with really not a happy childhood, not a happy young adulthood either. And so I started, like I mentioned earlier, I had this fascination with plants. So I had a friend, still have a friend, who was working with therapeutic use of different substances, plants and chemicals. And I started working with him and made some progress. It was really good work. Made some progress, let go of a lot of stuff. But there was still, on a really deep level, something that had not yet been dealt with. And so one day he calls me up and says, "Hey, I brought some ayahuasca from Peru. You've got to try this. This is the medicine for you." And so I thought about it deeply for about a tenth of a second and said yes. And that was, that was how that experience started. And by the time that whole thing, I didn't end in, it turned out to be Auschwitz where that vision was happening. And it didn't end there. It kept on going back and back and back in time through lifetimes, through human misery, through whatever it was. I'm not going to put labels on it. I don't like to label things. I like to keep them open-ended. But it ended up with everything gone. And I was just floating in this beautiful, peaceful, clear, sweet place, almost like I was a moth outside, flirting from flower to flower, drinking the nectar out of the flowers. And it was a major shift in me, because that was the moment when I had the realization that I wanted to work with ayahuasca as my medicine, as something I wanted to provide for people.
So that's what you've been doing since? Like hosting ceremonies, or?
Well, it took me about 10 years to get to hosting ceremonies, 15 years. I don't know. I'm mad with time, but a number of years.
Okay.
It's like the past is amorphous, But a number of years, 10, 15 years to get to where I could actually have the competency and the self-healing. That wasn't the end of my healing. That was the beginning of it. To have the competency to actually lead a ceremony.
And that's what you currently do these days?
It's what I've been doing. Now I'm doing more writing than leading ceremonies. Yeah, I'm still occasionally doing that in various places around the world.
What is it about? I've never used ayahuasca, but I've heard some extraordinary stories about it. I mean, what is your take, Richard, on what is going on there? Like, why is that plant allowing people to heal from things that seem to be really challenging to find solutions for outside of those types of tools?
That's the $20 billion question as to why ayahuasca. And in my experience with it, here's a leap of faith from Western mindset into shamanic mindset, is that ayahuasca is the combination of two plants. But the combination of the two plants opens up to a realm that people have called the world of ayahuasca, which is this entirely discrete universe that's within every person as well. That ayahuasca, the plant, the drink opens the doorway to. And in there, there's tremendous intelligence. There's tremendous kindness, although some people might disagree with that at certain points during an experience. But there's tremendous kindness. And there is an agenda to heal people. There is an agenda to heal. And that agenda to heal is really important because, you know, other plants don't have that. Like, for example, opium or has an agenda to numb.
Right. So do you think that agenda exists within the plant, or do you think the plant is almost like a key that unlocks some dimension that everybody has access to? We just don't have the sensory organ to tap into it on our own easily, and it's just like opening the door for us.
Yes. Yes, the second. Yeah, the plant is the key in the doorway. In the door that most people don't even know that they have.
Right.
You know, so it's finding the door, being willing to put the key in, being willing to turn the key, and then being willing to walk through the door.
Do you feel that ayahuasca invites you through the door or shoves you through the door?
Whatever you need.
The shoves through the door is terrifying to me. I've tinkered a little bit with different psychedelics, and I don't know. I'm fearful of ayahuasca. I don't know if it's my body trying to protect me and hiding me from something that I'm not ready for or what. Part of it is just the logistics too. Like, you know, I hear that, oh, you should go to Peru to do it. You should take a week. And it's like, I find travel in general stressful. Airports, like, oh, the whole thing. Like, I don't mind a 2.5 hour drive to the beach. Like, that's my kind of travel. But, like, the ordeal of going to another country for a week, like, that in itself might be the majority of the fear I have, just because I just don't like that. And maybe if it was in my backyard, I'd be more open-minded. But are there other psychedelics that you personally work with when you're leading people through, like, healing experiences? Or experiences with an intention to heal? Maybe I assume sometimes it doesn't go so well.
So far, you know, knock on wood, it goes very well for me for the most part, 99%. I'll work with San Pedro, which is another South American cactus. And for some people, it's better because ayahuasca can be spooky and San Pedro's not spooky. You know, spooky in that, man, I mean, some of the stuff that you can see, especially if the ceremony is not being led well and you don't get through it all, can be very confrontational, very terrifying. But terror's, you know, when a person is terrified and they get through their terror, they have conquered their terror.
Yeah, a lot of good things can come out of getting through, I assume.
Yeah, granted, for some people, they're not going to get through their terror. They don't want to get through their terror. And that's okay, too, because
they don't want to get through because you think it's protecting them in some way? Or
I think my only remaining fear is fear of heights. I've gone through the fear of spiders and ants and people and this and that, but put me at the edge of a cliff and there's nothing I can do other than get away.
When
I've hypnosis.
Well, now that you said that out loud, your next ceremony might put you there.
I've said that out loud 20 years ago.
Okay. San Pedro. So one time I was going through a tough time and a buddy of mine said, I have something for you. And he gave me a little canister of this green powder that he called San Pedro. And he said, and I didn't want to do anything like big. So he knew I was interested in like microdosing. And he said, take, you know, this amount, you know, get yourself a scale and weigh out, you know, half a gram and move up to maybe a gram, gram and a half or something. And I got to tell you, I did it. He said, do it every 3 or 4 days for a couple months. And it had such a tremendous impact on me. I mean, it was at a time where I really needed something to divert my mind or change the course of these like negative thought cycles I was having about some emotional stress I had that stemmed from like really young age. And man, it like was the perfect medicine at the perfect time. It was, and I tried to explain to some friends like what it's like. And the best I could come up with was it was like taking a teaspoon of the sun in the morning. And you just had this like, you know, when you walk out in the sun, if you've been inside all day and it just hits you, especially like coming out of the winter or something, it's just like it's so delicious to the body. Like everything, the whole body is just like, yes, thank you. Like I needed this so much. It's so nourishing in this bright, nourishing way. And it was like that energy, but it had this like, I don't know, grandfather-esque wisdom with it, where I was like calm and clear-headed, but I had limitless energy all day. Like I had some of the most productive days. Like if you ever just want to get a lot of shit done around the house, like I could just go from task to task, but not in like a racy, stressful energy, in like this clear-headed, calm, beautiful energy where it was very easy to look at everything in my life or everything through my day through a positive, like sunny lens. So these negative thought cycles that I was having, it was as if my subconscious was able to see them arising long before they came to fruition, and then had this like, they would have this cascade where like you think about this thing that sucks or that you feel sucks, you perceive as a sucky thing in your life or whatever. And that thought would lead to the next one and the next one. And every day it was like the same thoughts in the same cycle, in the same sequence, not all day, but like almost all day long. Like my brain would just attach to these. And it was like the medicine allowed my brain or my body to sense it before it arose and was like, oh, I see that it's arising. And then just like, I'm just going to go over here instead. And I just like wouldn't go down that path. And then as the month or two went on, everything was like shifting where they just stopped arising that way. And then I didn't have all the negative physiological responses to all those negative thoughts because every cell in the body seems to be listening. So when you would go through those sequences of negative thought to negative thought, every jump from one to the other was like a new wave of your physical body having a negative response to those thoughts. But they're just thoughts. Like they're not even, like, I don't even know where they are, or they're ideas that just emerge. And they're like, I don't even know if people understand where these things take place. Like, does it even have matter to it? Is it measurable? Maybe it's measurable as like activity in a certain area of a brain. I don't know. But it's just like, as I flex this muscle of witnessing the thoughts arise earlier and earlier, and then calmly saying like, oh, I don't need to go over there. I'll just go over here. And like the medicine allowed that process to just come naturally and easily. And it was like, you know, a teaspoon or half a teaspoon of this bitter powder that would like change my way of thinking and being in the world for the whole day with seemingly no negative effect. I mean, the taste wasn't great. I would wait. I had this process where I would drink my coffee and I would wait till there was like 2 ounces left in my coffee. I drink a big coffee. And when there was like 2 ounces left on those days, I would measure it out and put it in and just chug it. So it's just like one bitter swig. And then like everything was great. My workouts were great. I didn't have to like stopping from going to work. It's like, what an amazing thing that Earth provides to be able to allow us. And how the hell did anybody figure out how to get that out of that plant?
It's kind of wild how easy it is to feel disconnected from where our food comes from these days. We grab something off the shelf, toss it in the cart, and that's that. But every now and then, you come across something that reminds you, hey, real people grew this. Here's something real for you. 90% of American-grown frozen red raspberries, they come from a tight-knit community of farmers in Washington State. These are multi-generational family farmers, folks who've been working the land for decades, taking real pride in every berry they grow. This isn't just farming, it's legacy. It's local, and it's done with heart. These frozen Washington red raspberries are honestly juicy, delicious, and full of flavor because they're grown in nutrient-rich soil and frozen right at peak ripeness. It feels good to enjoy something that's not only high quality, but also backed by care, tradition, and purpose. These berries, they're not just tossed in a freezer. They're grown with intention by people who've dedicated their lives to perfecting them. From sustainable farming to state-of-the-art freezing techniques, everything is done to lock in flavor and nutrition. Whether you're cooking, baking, smoothie making, or eating straight from the bag, frozen Washington red raspberries give you the real taste of American farming. And yeah, you can tell the difference.
Go to redras.org and look for Product of the U.S. to learn more.
That's a mystery. You know, take two, ayahuasca, you take two plants from the jungle where there's, I think somebody captured it out. There's a little blurb in my book about this, but the chance of randomly choosing any two plants to put together in the jungle, the Amazon, is about picking one grain of sand off of all the beaches in the universe, about the same odds. So,
yeah, that's but, so you know, crazy.
Interesting, San Pedro is called the grandfather in South America. It's a very young, let's call it in Chinese medicine, Chinese philosophy, young, male, masculine, energetic, solar, light, warmth experience. So it does have that capacity to love you into submission in a way, you know, to like the grandfather. The job of a grandfather in our world, the ideal job, is that person that loves the grandchildren unconditionally and, you know, leave the disciplining and the punishment to the parents. The grandfather, grandmother, just love. Ayahuasca is the grandmother in most of the Amazon and, you know, feminine yin. And the way they grow shows this. Ayahuasca grows in the jungle, you know, in the depths of the jungle, this vine coming up out of very poor soil, but coming up out of this very poor soil, finding a tree and just struggling on up the tree to get to the light. San Pedro basks in the light. There's no competition for San Pedro.
Interesting.
Ayahuasca has to, you know, has to outcompete the other plants to survive. San Pedro's just like, you know, here I am. So it gives you that kind of here I am feeling too.
That's pretty wild. So yeah. Are there relationships like that in the other psychedelics where there's like an energy to them that seems to be represented by like the conditions needed for it to exist?
Interesting question. I don't know. I mean, the only other one that I've really experienced is mushrooms. They grow on dead things, you know. I don't know. I have to think about that. I'm not ready to commit myself to that yet.
I've tinkered with mushrooms too, and I feel like a lot of good benefits also, but I feel like I can't go to work and be good at my job.
No.
Whereas the San Pedro is like, I would be excellent at my job. Like I didn't lose anything. It enhanced everything. It was very interesting.
That's the chemical nature of San Pedro is more stimulating. You know, it does have, it's not an amphetamine, but it has similarities to amphetamines.
Oh, really?
It doesn't like waste you the way amphetamines do. You can take it every day for a while and no problem, but it has that kind of like, yeah, I can do anything feel to it. It's great. I mean, I used to love taking San Pedro and then doing Tai Chi for a couple hours. It was amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, I'm probably due for another, I don't know, exploration of it. I just like, I don't really feel like I need it now. And maybe that would just be greedy. I don't know. maybe there'd be a punishment for that. Like, I don't want to force a tool that's not needed. But I'm so grateful that it showed up in my life at the time it did. It taught me a lot about myself and definitely helped me just connect more with, like, how beautiful this planet is and how perfect everything seems to be. Granted, there's ugly sides to it, too, but...
It's not our work as conscious human beings to focus on increasing the beauty inside, you know, where we have the connection to the divine within our heart. And, you know, I think humans have tried for a really long time to fight the negative. And generally, other than some temporary remissions, it's kind of like a similarity to the philosophy of Western medicine of here's a disease, the disease is the enemy. And not saying that this is wrong, because it has weight, it has reality too, but it's a different philosophy. you know, here's the disease. And if I had a bad disease, I would definitely want to take whatever could get rid of the disease, you know. But, you know, here's the disease. Let's kill it. Let's kill it. Let's get rid of it. Whereas in the plant medicine world, it's like, here's the disease. The disease is the fruit on an unhealthy tree. What's wrong with the tree? What's going on down in the roots? You know, and if we can get the roots working, you know, take away the blockages that are preventing nourishment from getting from the roots to the heart, to the leaves, to the fruit, maybe, perhaps, hopefully, the fruit will get better. And, you know, so it's a totally different philosophy and way of looking at things. And that's where, again, trust and forgive comes in, because no matter how much technology I have, if my heart is heavy, if my heart is holding the weight of my past, holding the weight of all the other people who I've interfaced with in my life, holding every guilt, remorse, shame, whatever it is, how on earth can the energy of life flow freely in me? It can't. And that creates the milieu, the background, the field wherein disease can more easily take root and flourish. It's like the old naturopathic thing is like, which does the mosquito create the swamp, or does the swamp create the mosquito? You know, you need the swamp to make the mosquito. The mosquito's not going to make the swamp. The mosquito is the disease. The swamp is the background of body, mind, and spirit. Body, mind, and soul, if you will. So, you know, when I was in China, I didn't work in one of the hospitals there, but some friends of mine working in a hospital there, and it would be normal for somebody to go get surgery and come back to their room, and in their room is a acupuncturist and an herbalist giving them Chinese herbs and acupuncture to help their recovery process. That's something that is lacking in our world, in the Western world. I don't know if they're still doing that in China, but it was really wonderful for the patients. You know, so I think we have to cover all of these bases. And one of the bases that hasn't been covered in Eurocentric culture is forgiveness and trusting life, trusting reality. And I just wanted to, can I back up a little bit?
Yeah.
Because you were talking about have the Sampira give you choice. And if we go back in mythological time periods, there's always the idea of the god at the crossroad. Shulegba and Yoruba, gosh, this is all in my book too, but there's the idea of the gods at the crossroad that will help you, if you so choose, make the proper choice. Sometimes they're tricksters, so you got to be careful. But, you know, the idea of choice is like an ill person, a traumatized person has been running, or even a person that thinks too much, has been running a specific pattern in their brain for years, decades, you know, months, weeks, years, decades, whatever it is. They'd be running a pattern. They have like the exact way they go to work every day, so much so that they've worn a rut in the road or the pathway that they walk to work on. And they can no longer see that there are other options. So something like San Pedro Ayahuasca comes in and says, look, here are so many options for you that you can take. Here are so many options that you can choose to take. And so in that, there's freedom. There's more freedom. You know, whatever it is, even learning a song, even music, even how a person paints, whatever it is, people get in ruts. And sometimes getting blown out of those ruts is super valuable.
Yeah, I agree. I remember when I was using it, I was in a little skateboarding phase with my son. My son was an avid skateboarder, and I was doing it just as a old man to try to connect with him. And for a year or two, we skateboarded together. And I would try to time it sometimes where on those San Pedro days, I would be going skateboarding. And there was something that took place when, like, skateboarding is basically you're basically just learning. You're trying to learn something new and create a new neural pathway so that you could have this like repeatable thing. So there was like a cleanliness to my ability to learn something new on those days. So I recognized, and I was able to take advantage of that. And I found that like I would skateboard better. Like I didn't have bad habits in the way. I had I didn't have those ruts in the neural pathways between my brain and like how my ankle was doing its, you know, flippy thing to make the board do this. It was subtle, but it was noticeable and repeatable. And I would even like pair it with some other mushrooms like lion's mane or something to get like that. What is it? Brain-derived neurotropic effect, like the creation of new neural brain neural pathways. Like just get some fuel for that when I was trying to learn a high-speed mechanical activity, and it would be helpful. It's weird. It's like, I wonder where else that could be useful in so many ways, probably.
Well, so you know, if you go back into Zen, there's the idea of the beginner's mind, you know, and they say each person should be every day in beginner's mind. Because the beginner is curious. Beginner is exploring all the possibilities.
Richard, touch on forgiveness a little bit. So trust and forgiveness. What role do you think forgiveness plays as a medicine or for someone that's trying to heal some type of trauma?
It's fundamental. It's absolutely fundamental. And it's also a very interesting topic. And forgiveness for most people means making okay the perpetrator or the event that caused the trauma. And that's not what forgiveness in my viewpoint is. That was when I was stuck in that Auschwitz scene, is what does forgiving Hitler look like? You know, what does that mean? And, you know, so the forgiveness, the place that is being wounded by not forgiving is in me. The place that's, you know, holding on so tight is in me, blocking circulation, blocking breath, blocking life energy. So that's in me. And so forgiveness, metaphorically and actually somewhat realistically, is like,
whew. It's never about the other person or the event.
It's not, because unless a person's in an active traumatizing situation, that other person only exists in their mind. You know, 50 years, 60 years later, Hitler exists only in people's minds. So, and I'll stop using Hitler now because it's not the greatest. You know, the perpetrator only exists in the mind of the person who was victimized by the perpetrator. And so the forgiveness is not forgiving that person. It's not even, you know, like, I'm sorry is good in communication, but in the internal realm, it doesn't work because it's just another concept. What does sorry mean? What does I mean? You know, but if I can locate that place within me, in my field, in my, you know, the vastness of whatever human being is, if I could locate that within me and let it go so that it is washed away by time, which it is being done anyway. Eventually, all these things are going to be no longer existent. But if I can let that trauma wash away by the winds of time, then it no longer exists in a way in me that is making me the victim of my holding on to my own pain. I still have the memory, but when I go to the memory, it no longer is a monster under the bed.
Right.
It's something that I've befriended. So it no longer has power over me.
In my own experience, I feel like I've always been quick to forgive others and haven't really held a lot of or created a lot of suffering for myself around outside events or other people. But the things that create shame and guilt in myself have been very challenging. So forgiveness to me personally as a practice has been mostly centered around forgiving myself. And that's been quite a journey ongoing. And I've made a ton of progress of that, but it's, you know, there's more. For sure there's more. But my wife once said something that was very interesting to me. She said, you have to forgive yourself for falling victim to the beliefs that you had about yourself in your past. Like when I look back at the things that I hold shame and guilt around, they're all around like things that, like actions and behaviors that I've had in the past. And like I have to be able to be compassionate and understand, like, oh, I did those things for a reason. Like, there's a part of me that was trying to help myself in some way, whether protect myself, either, you know, something, whether it was like running away from something painful or towards something desired, but there was something that I needed that part of me was trying to provide. And that's why I did those things. So there were like beliefs about myself at the heart of those actions and behaviors. And I have to learn how to forgive myself for like having those beliefs. They like wasn't my fault. It was just things that like my soul had to create to try to help the situation at the time. And that's been like helpful to me, you know, and being able to see like, oh, that's just, it's not just that that's who I was then and I'm not that now. It's just like the parts that we're made of are always developing in different directions and different rates. And at that time in my life, I wasn't resourced to do anything different than I did. I did exactly like everybody does, whatever they can do with the tools they have at the time. And having that framework and being able to be compassionate for like my younger self has been helpful as my older self to tap into forgiveness and to allow it and to let go more and more. I thought it was an interesting insight. She's always full of good insights.
It's a beautiful insight. You know, I do an exercise with people sometimes. Like, you have to imagine that, screw it down, this water bottle's a stick, right? So I'll hand it to somebody and say, this is stuff in me I don't like anymore. Can you please take this away? And they grab it, and they pull on it, and they pull on it, and they pull on it.
All right.
You know, I'm fairly strong. There's so far been nobody who's gotten it away from me. But that's the idea, is like, what is holding on to you, you're also holding on to.
For sure.
Some of these realizations are like so stupid simple. Like, why don't we all get this? Why don't we all realize that if I'm feeling shame and guilt inside of myself, I'm also in relationship with that shame and guilt and holding on to it in some way.
Well, it can be terrifying to, you know, you start to identify with things and you're terrified of losing your identity.
You know, who are you without it?
You don't know how to be. I mean, I talk to people that have been in pain for a long time. It's like, what would you do if you woke up tomorrow without pain? Like, I wouldn't even know what to do with myself. Like, have you even given it? You think about your pain all the time, every day. Do you ever give any time and attention? Do you ever think about what it would be like even without it? It's like, it's not even imaginable. And it's like the things that you're like, If you hate part of yourself and resent part of yourself for like some past things, you might not feel like you deserve to be let off the hook. Like, I don't deserve to not have this shame or guilt because I did these bad things.
What is this deserve thing? You know, what is that? Who is it that has the right to tell another person or tell themselves that they don't deserve to have a fulfilling, beautiful, rich life?
Yeah.
In whatever situation they're in, you know, who is it that has the right to do that? If you told your child that they didn't deserve to be happy, what kind of parent would that make you? Not a very good one. Don't do it. Not a very good one. If I tell myself that I don't deserve to be happy, I mean, like, WTF, you know, why do we allow ourselves to do that to ourselves? And there's layers upon layers of reasons for that. I'm not saying it's easy, but, you know, that the process of growth, the process of going to these crossroads of life and making the right choices is not an easy process. This is a hero's path. You know, the path of healing is the hero's path, because I could certainly, you know, call up a doctor, my doctor, and say, I'm anxious, I need some Ativan. I could go 10 minutes later and pick up 90 tabs of Ativan and have no problem for the next 90 days, or however long it lasts, till I run out of it, of course. You know, that's a necessary path for some in certain acute conditions, yeah. But how much more challenging is it, and how much more rewarding is it to be at that crossroad and say, well, I'm not going to go down, you know, what was that book, The Road Less Traveled, a long time ago? Beautiful title. most people going on the road more traveled, which is the easy path, path of least resistance, path of least work.
Well, path in Western medicine, immediate. That's encouraged too. I mean, a doctor gets 15 minutes with you and you have an acute situation and they have, that's the toolkit. So you can't blame them for using the toolkit they have. It's just passing time. It might just be making the underlying thing fester more. And when you do lift the rug up, it's a bigger monster under there because you just put it off longer and longer.
Yeah, Western medicine has saved my life more than once.
Oh, it's a miracle. It can do miracles.
I have no problem with Western medicine or its philosophy. I'm talking about, you know, on this place, the crossroads is like, that's an individual choice for me to choose, you know, the instant quick fix or for me to choose to do the work necessary to really heal. Finding a moldy place in the wall and painting over it or digging it out and repairing it.
But forgiveness is such a, as you say, fundamental part of that. I mean, there's probably so much chronic illness where it might not be the only thing, but there's a component where people are holding on to stuff either towards other people or events or themselves. And it's like a lot of people still don't realize that forgiveness is not about letting someone else off the hook. It's about freeing yourself. I read this story. I wish I remembered the book name. It was in like my phase of just binge reading self-help books for a decade or so. But this guy references story of a woman who was really facing her like son's murderer. So her son was murdered, and I'm going to butcher this, but long story short, she winds up showing up to the trial, or when her son's murderer gets out of prison and she realizes he doesn't really have anything in his life, she winds up like taking him in, employing him, housing him, and eventually adopting him. Adopts her son's murderer. Ultimately, I think, to heal her pain, to help her, like that process of forgiveness allowed her to heal from the pain of losing her son. And it was so powerful. Like, I was bawling my eyes out just listening to this thing on audiobook. Like, I don't know what it is about stuff like that. It touches me big time.
Beautiful. I heard a story about a man in Africa. I'm not going to give the details on this in case there's anything could come back to him, but he was in Africa, in one of the countries that was undergoing a horrible civil war. And this one general of the opposing forces butchered his brother, you know, just tore him to pieces, ate his liver, you know, and horrible. So the other guy spends years looking for this general who killed his brother, and finally, after many years, found him. And walked up to him and said, you know, you killed my brother. Now you have to be my brother.
Mm. That's
forgiveness, you know, that's forgiveness.
There's just something about it, though, that I think is freaking beautiful. I don't know.
It's godly. I mean, it's godly.
Well, it's like the story of Jesus on the cross. Like, I don't know how he says it, but it's like, you know, forgive them for they don't know. Like he's trying to save their soul.
Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do.
Yeah. Like he wasn't doing that to help himself. He was.
He was.
He was doing it to help them.
I don't believe it.
Oh, you think he was? Yeah.
I think it was him, because he had every reason and right in the universe to be really pissed, you know. But he just went, okay, forgive them. I let go. I release into thy hands. I commend my spirit, you know. It was that his release, his letting go, so that not only did those who were the perpetrators find forgiveness from him, but he forgave them. It's a two-way road. And when a person forgives the perpetrator in this way, again, not in making it okay, that's really important to know, because most people think that they can't forgive, because if they do, it makes it okay. But if they can forgive in that letting it completely out of their selves, out of their body, mind, and spirit, that's such a beautiful, deep healing that woman taking in the murderer of her son, that general, I mean, that person adopting the general who killed his brother as his brother. You know, there's millions of stories, like, not enough, but there's many stories like this.
Yeah.
There used to be many more. These are the things that make a difference. These are the things that change reality.
And I personally, I think it really goes hand in hand with compassion. Like, I feel like when you see that, like, you know, that you hear this saying, like, hurt people, or like, my wife also brought this point to me once, where when you see somebody that is maybe doing something that's, you know, I don't want to say not their best self, like where they're expressing themselves at a really low frequency, the question is like, what happened to them? Like when you ask, like I was talking to somebody in my gym, it was a trainer that is at my gym, and he was opening up one day about like a sibling, a brother that, you know, he felt really went down the wrong path relative to him. And, you know, he should be doing this. He should have this. He should that. And lots of judgment and such. And I once asked him, this was like soon after I heard this advice from my wife. I asked him like, well, what happened to him? And he was like a deer in the headlights. Like he never pondered that question. And then he thought back on like his son's childhood. And it was like this massive perspective. And here he is like, I'm holding all this judgment towards one of the most important people in my life. And all this negativity and all this resentment and anger. And it's like, oh, I see why he did those things. It's like an on-ramp to forgiveness. It's like understanding. It's like, oh, I could see. Like when you see somebody that was raised in just a very different scenario than you, you could see that, oh, they were a product of our environment. So like, what do they say? You're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. Like it's impossible not to be affected. The way I put it is we're always showing up in the world with this cumulative momentum of all the moments that have of our life that led up to that. And people say, well, oh, if I was them, I would do something different. It's like, no, you wouldn't. If you were them, you'd do the same damn thing, because that person can only do the thing that they're doing because their life brought them up to that moment. You know, the collection of every amount of stress, every good or bad night's sleep, every environmental, every shitty teacher or great teacher or role model they had all led to that. They can't do anything different. Now, we change over time, but in a moment, you can't do what you're going to do 30 seconds from now any different than what you're going to do 30 seconds from now.
This is where plant medicines can come in really handy. And even if not plant medicines, the philosophy or the work of trusting and forgiving can come in really handy. I'll tell you two short stories that have really influenced me a lot. When I was practicing Aikido, one of the big teachers was talking about how when he lived in Japan for many years, and he was several dan black belt, several degrees of black belt in Aikido. He could take care of himself, you know, strong, big guy. And one day he's on a bus or a subway, I don't remember which, let's call it a bus. And this guy came on the bus and he was drunk and he was bothering all the passengers and being obnoxious. And as he's getting closer and closer to him, he's thinking, oh, you know, I can take this guy. I can get him off this bus. I can take care of him. I'm tough, you know. I know Aikido. I'm good. And the guy's getting closer and closer. And then a couple seats in front of him is this older man sitting with, you know, on the edge, and he slides over and pats the seat and says, here, my friend, come sit here. And the drunk guy, being obnoxious, sat down, and the old man looks at him and says, what's your pain? Tell me about your pain. And he broke down crying. His wife had just died, and he was drunk. And, you know, so he spent the whole bus ride or train ride crying on the old man's shoulder until he felt better. And my friend, my teacher, saw this and said, well, that's Aikido. That's martial arts. That's the highest martial arts. And then one other thing is I had a woman in one of my ceremonies a while ago who had not spoken with her mother in 30 years, just nothing but hate for her, both directions, bidirectional hate. And she spent the entire ceremony forgiving every single aspect of every drop of any connection that she had to her mother until she was clean of it. ceremony ends, she goes to her room, picks up her phone. Her mother had called her, first time in 30 years.
Huh.
You know, so if I'm healing here, I'm also at least creating the space for there to be healing out there. You know, that's one of the miracles of this work, is your judgment on, or that man's judgment on his son, locked his son into being trapped by his judgment. Because it's, you know, who's holding on to what.
Right.
And so that's a beautiful arc that healing can take, is that it won't always happen, you know, but it does happen. Things like that.
Well, I applaud you for playing your role and trying to make it happen more often for people, make the world a better place, man. How do people find out more about you and obtain your book?
Really easy. So in Egyptian cosmology, there's the idea that when a person dies, they go in front of Osiris, I believe, who takes their heart out and gives it to Maat, who puts it on a scale, and on one side is the heart, on the other side is the feather. So if the heart weighs more than the feather, the person doesn't get to move on to heaven. And so I called my thing Heart Feather.
Okay.
Many years ago. So heartfeather.com, all one word, so that we may learn to have our hearts as light as a feather, so that when we are judged, which is every moment of every day, our hearts can be getting lighter and lighter and lighter.
And the book is available on there?
It's not available there. There's a link there, but it's on Amazon also.
Okay. Trust and Forgive.
Trust and Forgive.
The Medicine of Your Life, Dr. Richard Grossman. I really appreciate you taking the time today. I'm glad you reached out. I really enjoyed our conversation. And
likewise.
Glad to be, honored to be a conduit for your message. And hopefully our paths will cross again sometime. For the listeners, always grateful for your listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope everybody out there has a great day.